It's like something out of a science fiction movie. Every night, about 10 o'clock, my refrigerator begins to glow. It exudes a heavenly light. It speaks in an angelic whisper. It says, "Just a bite. You've been so good all day. Surely you deserve a bedtime snack." Am I hungry? Well, no, not really, but we don't eat only to assuage hunger, do we? It's your cousin's birthday. Here comes the fancy birthday cake and ice cream, too. Someone new has moved into the neighborhood while you bring over a welcoming loaf of zucchini bread. Each year, the Jews celebrate Passover. The telling of the Exodus story is punctuated with special food items on the Seder plate. Bitter herbs, a hard-cooked egg, matzah. On Christmas Eve, we encourage our children and grandchildren to leave cookies and milk for Santa. And let's not forget our national Thanksgiving holiday, when more than the turkey gets stuffed. Food is not only sustenance, it's also ritual. It's reward. It's tradition. Food is important to us spiritually. According to world-renowned opera star Luciano Pavarotti, one of the very nicest things in life is the way we must regularly stop whatever it is we are doing and devote our attention to eating. But in the haste of our daily lives, we often take food for granted. We eat without thinking and without thankfulness. More often than is healthful, we eat on the run, grabbing a sandwich, hitting the drive-thru on the way to work, or, gasp, watching TV as an accompaniment to our meal. The Norman Rockwell portrait of a family around the table holding hands in prayer is a bit of a relic. But there are physical and emotional and spiritual health reasons to resurrect the practice. Jews, Muslims, Hindus, Christians all have religious laws and customs related to food. Of course, we're all familiar with keeping kosher and the fact that Muslims won't go near pork and Hindus won't eat beef, because cows are considered sacred. Many Catholics don't eat meat on Fridays, and most devout Christians offer spoken prayers of thanks to God before lifting a fork at mealtimes. But did you know that many of the world's religions have instructions on the proper manner in which to consume a meal? Now that's micromanagement. Do we need to slow down and savor our food, as in the raisin meditation? Well, maybe not that slow, but an unhurried meal has many benefits, and it's encouraged by many faith practices. In preparing for this talk, I found a website that contained, quote, rules of digestive hygiene from Jewish Health and Wellness, a website. There isn't enough time in this short message to spell out the so-called rules that are listed there, but it's interesting to note the first two. Number one. Take a moment before you begin eating to pray or meditate. Saying prayers mindfully and with intention creates a sacred space for you before you begin your meal. Rule number two, make time to enjoy your food. In today's busy world, this may be difficult to do, but when you eat, make sure to be mindful of how fast you are consuming your food. Take the time to slow down and really enjoy what you are eating. This is all part of the rule number two. At an Islamic site, I found the Muslims are expected to remember Allah before meals. The site reported, and I quote, "Scientists have only now proven the benefits of deep breathing and relaxation before, during, and after meals." And I'm still continuing to quote, "This practice increases nutrient absorption and allows the body to introduce the correct and healthy enzymes to break down the foods. Blessings, prayer, or silent contemplation before eating will improve digestion, assimilation, and well-being." So what about Unitarian Universalists? Do we say blessings before meals? Is there anyone who would like to share what you do at your house? I wasn't expecting a response, so don't worry. So it's like, shovel it in. Well, I did my...
Whether I'm at home or I'm out with friends, I always invite people to say bon appetit.
All right, bon appetit. Very good.
Something similar in a non-denomination.
Very nice. They say bon appetit. So I did my homework, and I found a variety of UU prayers of thankfulness to be spoken before meals. Here is one example. For what we are about to receive, let us be truly thankful to those who prepared and served it. Let us remember, too, those who have none, who cannot share this plenty. Let us be truly thankful for the good in our lives and commit once again to bringing more good into the world. So I've included that one and five more on a printed handout. Looks like this. For those of you who may be interested in the concept of saying grace before meals, and you'll find copies on the center yellow table back there. It's a purple sheet. So feel free to pick one up and take it home if you like. So many of us enjoy cooking, and I'll go out on a limb here and say we all enjoy eating. And we certainly enjoy sharing. We bring items each week for the food pantry. We've prepared and served meals for the homeless. Both activities are a testament to our desire to share food with those less fortunate. We've engaged in food competitions and tastings here and have addressed the subject of food purchase, preparation, and home gardening in workshops on ethical eating, although it's been a while. And I would venture to say that we see food as part of our spiritual outreach. After all, we have food after every service. One might say that sharing food, especially here with each other in this sacred space, is a UU form of communion. Now, I had considered including communion as part of this service, thought it might be interesting for each of us to take a small piece of, angel food cake from a tray and go through some kind of introspective ceremony. But due to time constraints, I dismissed the idea for today. And frankly, I didn't want to risk offending any of you who may have been raised Catholic or Episcopalian or one of the other Christian denominations. I found, however, that there actually are some UU churches that have communion ceremonies of a sort. And I read an interesting sermon online from Reverend Richard Beale from the First Universalist Church of Norway, Maine. Who knew there was a Norway in Maine on this topic? So here's what Reverend Beale had to say. Few of our churches have any celebration of communion with bread or wine, which comes, I think, from the fact that many UUs come out of churches where communion was either not explained very well or where theologically the bread and wine were believed to be turned symbolically into the actual body and blood of Christ. I've heard people say this smacked too much of cannibalism for them to be able to take part. But from the beginnings of Unitarianism in East Central Europe in the 1500s and Universalism in the 1600s and 1700s in England and the early American colonies, we have never understood communion to be anything but a memorial meal in honor of Jesus and his followers who celebrated Passover shortly before his death outside Jerusalem. There's never been any suggestion of the bread and wine or grape juice being anything or turning into anything but bread and wine and grape juice. Reverend Beale says he's comfortable with a much broader interpretation of the concept, one that puts the emphasis on the root meaning of communion, which is fellowship, mutual participation, and sharing. And I'm comfortable with that too. In fact, one could say that what we do at our refreshment table after services or at our harvest dinner or just for flavor dinners or other activities in which we share food is take communion. We break bread together every Sunday in a companionable fashion. We appreciate each other's efforts to bring beautiful strawberries, homemade baked goods, well-prepared sandwiches, cut vegetables and dips, and the simple foods like packaged cookies, crackers, and cheese. So perhaps no special communion is required here during our church service. We already have it afterward, minus the liturgy. So what is the spiritual nature of food? According to noted food writer Tanith Tir, ingredients are not sacred. The art of cuisine is sacred, he continued. It is at that altar I worship, the holy icons of the chef's faith, fragrant truffles, rich foie gras, well-marbled meats, and other luxurious ingredients. Their synthesis and their miraculous transformation into a sum greater than its parts is creation. And this is what I find worthy of reverence. I also found this quote from Voltaire. Nothing would be more tiresome than eating and drinking if God had not made them a pleasure as well as a necessity. When researching this subject, I came upon a website entitled sacredbite.com, in which the author referred to food as a living, dynamic metaphor for the divine. I think the author of the New York Times bestseller, Women, Food, and God, would agree. Published in 2011, the actual full title is Women, Food, and God, An Unexpected Path to Almost Everything. The author, Janine Roth, doesn't seem particularly religious. In fact, I'd wager she's a UU, or should be. The book is aimed squarely at women who have issues with diet and weight loss. And as you can guess from the title, she marries these concerns with deeper spiritual issues. Roth claims that our relationship to food is an exact microcosm of our relationship to life itself. To quote from the book, I believe we are walking, talking expressions of our deepest convictions. Everything we believe about love, fear, transformation, and God is revealed in how, when, and what we eat. When we inhale Reese's peanut butter cups when we're not hungry, we're acting out of an entire world of hope or hopelessness, of faith or doubt, of love or fear. If we are interested in finding out what we actually believe, not what we think, not what we say, but what our souls are convinced is the bottom line truth about life and afterlife, we need go no further than the food on our plates. It's pretty profound. Janine Roth goes on to say, I've learned that each of us has a basic view of reality and God, and that we act out every day in our relationship with our families, our friends, our food. It doesn't matter whether we believe in one God, many gods, or no God. Anyone who breathes and thinks and experiences has beliefs about God. Our daily lives, from the mundane to the sublime, from our reactions to sitting in traffic to our responses to the death of someone we love, are expressions of our deepest beliefs. To discover what you really believe, Roth writes, pay attention to the way you act, to what you do when things don't go the way they should. Pay attention to what you value. Pay attention to how and on what you spend your time and money, and pay attention to the way you eat. I've heard that to succeed at losing weight, it's not as important to know what you're eating as to know what's eating you. Perhaps that's a very brief summation of Roth's book. When you pay attention, you will discover if you believe the world is a hostile place and that you need to be in control of the immediate universe for things to go smoothly. You will discover if you believe that there is not enough to go around, and that taking more than you need feels necessary for survival. You will find out that if you believe that being quiet is unbearable, and that being alone means being lonely, if feeling your feelings means being destroyed, if being vulnerable is for sissies, or if opening to love is a big mistake. And you will discover how you use food to express each of these core beliefs. Whatever your dreams, do you believe you aren't worthy or that you aren't good enough or smart enough or talented enough? What many people do is give up and turn to food because food is instant, available, doesn't talk back, doesn't go away, and doesn't say no. You can tell where you've given up or how you've given up when food becomes your hugs, your kisses, your best friends, or your biggest relationship. Janine Roth holds retreats for women to explore their relationship with food. And here today, I have a couple of short handouts, more handouts, that may help you explore your inner relationship with food. Take them home to ponder if you wish. It's up to you. They're little half-sheet papers that look like this, again on the back table, if you want to explore on your own. No need to hand any homework in. This is just for your own self-awareness. So you, let's see, okay. So I have some Christian friends who made various suggestions when I told them I would be giving a service on this subject. Some of what they offered was quite interesting, but offered a bit too late, as I had many of these words already written. But in the book of Genesis, God places Adam in the garden to work it and watch over it, and to eat the vegetables and fruits, all except one, of course. Now, I take all this to be metaphorical, but it makes me smile to think about a forbidden fruit, something always depicted as an apple, although the word apple doesn't actually appear in the Bible. Funny that Adam blames Eve in the fruit incident and she blames the snake. No one is taking personal responsibility. In any case, it seems the concept of forbidden foods is as old as humanity itself. You probably learned along the path of your life that certain foods are forbidden for one reason or another. Probably each of us has an unspoken list of forbidden foods. Anyone want to mention one or two that they consider forbidden in their current state of mind or existence? I'm sorry? Sugar. Okay. Yes. Meat. Meat. Yes.
Pizza.
Pizza. No. What's on that pizza? So, yeah, we grow up with certain notions, and we learn through our reading and exploring and sometimes from parents and friends about what should be really forbidden. And so I would encourage you to explore which foods you consider forbidden on one of these little sheets and why you have come to believe it. But it's those foods that we often gravitate toward when we eat mindlessly. Often they're in the same category as so-called comfort foods, foods like chocolate or mac and cheese or ice cream. Eating such foods is often a substitute for dealing with painful feelings. So have you ever noticed that the word desserts, spelled backward, is the word stressed? Don't know where I came across that one, but it's kind of interesting. So using food to block anxiety is fairly common. Food is medicine. Actually, when it comes to chocolate, cocoa has actually been used for centuries as an herbal medicine, particularly in Central America, where it's been used to treat fevers, coughs, and discomfort associated with pregnancy. But seriously, most of us recognize when we're turning to food for some kind of medicinal purpose in times of depression or despair or a case of the jitters. One of the books I have on my shelf is called The Writing Diet by Julia Cameron, who is author of The Artist's Way. How many of you are familiar with The Artist's Way? Quite a few. It's a book about creativity. Julia Cameron discovered after years of conducting creativity workshops that a lot of her students were getting thinner. Pleasant side effect, unrelated to the course material. Invigorated by the rebirth of their creative selves in Cameron's 12-week workshop, these people were slimming down, substituting food for thought for actual food. Their newfound creativity was fulfilling, whereas food was simply filling. Overeating blocks our creativity, Cameron wrote. The flip side is also true. We can use creativity to block our overeating. In this book, filled with dozens of practical exercises, she suggests that when you're tempted to reach for the potato chips as a balm for your anxiety, you might grab a pen instead and list 5 current worries. Then write down 1 small positive action you can take to alleviate each worry. And then do it. Do worries send you to the refrigerator? Yeah, I see a few heads acknowledging that. We all just do our best. Now, at my house, the refrigerator still glows at night with the promise of a bedtime snack. And there is ice cream in there for the times when I'm not ready to face what may be troubling me. But the fridge also contains fresh cucumbers, tomatoes, avocados, and spinach, pineapple, peaches, strawberries, and apples, the forbidden fruit.